This is 89.9 WWNO. Yes, we're headed for another art-filled week. Are you making plans or do you need some ideas? Well, you've come to the right place. Whether you're in the mood for an athletic evening of contemporary ballet, a historical drama that examines the life of Israel's Golda Meir, or conversation with the president of the League of American Orchestras. It's all in the mixed media. Come along as we go inside the arts. Hi, I'm your host, Diane Mack. Dancers, athletes, and gymnasts gear up for a jaw-dropping performance as the internationally acclaimed Jacques Haim, artistic director and founder of the Diavolo Dance Theater, brings his troupe of daredevils to the Crescent City. The New Orleans Ballet Association presents the Diavolo Dance Theater, accompanied by the Louisiana Philharmonic Orchestra, in a performance that combines dance with architecture. Joining me now is Diavolo's founder, Jacques Haim. Welcome to Inside the Arts.
Eh bien, bonjour. Bonjour à tous. Welcome. Thank you for having me.
And welcome back to New Orleans. How do you plan to dazzle audiences with your unique troupe of dancers?
You know, after 15 years of touring nationally and internationally, I'm still excited about what we do. And if I was a French chef, let me tell you the recipe of Diavolo. I will put a little bit of ballet. I will put a little bit of modern dance. I will put a little bit of gymnastic, a little bit of acrobacy, a little bit of martial arts, a little bit of hip-hop, everyday movement. Then I will add abstract structures and more recognized structures, and I will tweak the salad, and there you have it. That's the Diavolo recipe.
My.
Basically, if what we do on stage is a live abstract painting. It's architecture in motion. So therefore, it's quite a different company. It's not really pure dance, it's not theater, it's not circus, it's quite different. So just with that, it is exciting to watch.
So how did you come to marry the athleticism of dance with industrial architectural structures?
You know, I grew up in Paris, France. I was kicked out of six different schools. My parents told me, Jacques, you need to go to the land of opportunity, to America. That was in 1983. So I went to Middlebury College in Vermont. I went into the theater department, but at that time, my English was so bad. So I had some friends in the dance department who told me, Jacques, why don't you come and take some dance classes? At least you don't have to speak. And I said, okay, great. So I really fell in love with movement. And in a different life, I wish I could be an architect. I love architecture, but at that time, I didn't have the discipline. So later, I decided to, when I started a dance company, after Middlebury College, I went to California Institute of the Arts, CalArts, in California. I graduated in 91 and started my dance company. And there, I decided to mix love for human motion and love for architecture. And I really find out in 1992, 1993, when I started my dance company, Diavolo, that there were not a lot of dance company that was doing this kind of work. So it was exciting. I'm interested about the action and interaction between the human body and the architectural environment, how fragile we are, how powerful we are, how vulnerable we are. And so that's really the work of Diavolo. Themes, you know, this is very abstract what we do. So the audience, in a way, have to do 50% of the work, meaning they have to use their own imagination to create their own interpretation and their own stories. Themes, though, are human struggle, human condition, fear, danger, survival, chaos, order, destiny, destination, deconstruction, construction, faith, love. That's a little bit about Diavolo.
And Diavolo, how did you come to this name, and does it mean something?
Yes, you know, a long time ago when I started the company, I didn't want to call it Jacques Haim Dance Company. I thought that was going to be a little pompous. So I wanted a name that was catching, mysterious, that American could pronounce, and also European. And so Diavolo came about. I remember long, long time ago, I was in a plane, and I was sitting next to a woman, and I was searching for names, and we ended up talking about what I wanted to do, and she helped me to find this name. And then later on, I researched the meaning. So Diavolo means devil in Italian, but it's more like a little rascal, which is what I was when I was a kid. Also, Dia, D-I-A, it's a Greek prefix. It means going from obstacle to obstacle, which is what we do in our
And you are going to debut your latest work here in New Orleans, Fluid Infinities, featuring the Louisiana Philharmonic Orchestra. Tell me, what will audiences experience?
Fluid Infinities is part of a trilogy that is called L'Espace du Temps, Space of Time. The trilogy is commissioned by the Los Angeles Philharmonic Orchestra, and it started in 2007 with Foreign Bodies by the music of Esa-Pekka Salonen, which is the beginning of awareness in a world of ever-changing geometry. Then the second installment in 2010 was Fearful Symmetries by the music of John Adams. The theme is teamwork in a mechanical world. And the last installment, the finale, in 2013, we premiered that at the Hollywood Bowl, Fluid Infinities, the music by Philip Glass, Symphony No. 3. The theme is exploration of a new world turns into a ritual and leads them to inner spirituality. That's Fluid Infinities.
You have several other works on the program. What else will we see?
So we're going to have a piece called Detour, which is basically a 12-feet-high wall, 8 feet wide, with metallic pegs coming out of the wall. And basically the theme there is the chaos of everyday life through a military obstacle course. Then they're going to see a duet, and this duet is basically a 6 years relationship in 6 minutes, something very French. And then they're going to see a piece called Bench, which is a very simple piece with six dancers about possession, grabbing the band, pushing each other. It's kind of a fun piece. And then they're going to see a piece called Yumakina, which is about sort of modern time, the beginning of time in a way. You'll see first a small structure, and you don't know exactly what it is, and then eventually all the dancers put the three other pieces together with the fourth piece, and they realize it created a wheel. And the wheel was the metaphor of modernization in a way.
So tell me, how did you turn dance into what some see as an extreme sport?
Because when I started to really mix structures and what I was thinking about, what I wanted to do, mixing the fusion of many different movement vocabulary, suddenly it became very acrobatic-esque. It became very intense. It became very powerful in a way. So, you know, because we don't do pieces on the bare stage, which is something completely different, as soon as you mix structures and architectural environment and you have the dancers, which, by the way, the dancers, the five women and the five men, actually create, choreograph all the pieces, and I just direct them. And so they move inside and around and on top and under those structures. And so it's a representation a little bit of our society, of our urban life. Therefore, it's very vibrant, chaotic, and with order. That's why it's pretty intense.
Wow. What are you hoping audiences will take away from this experience?
The audience will be seeing something that it looks familiar, but not really, and they cannot really totally describe, but there's something mesmerized about the work that we do.
Jacques, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jacques Haim is the founder and artistic director of the Los Angeles-based Diavolo Dance Theater. The New Orleans Ballet Association presents the Diavolo Dance Theater, accompanied by the Louisiana Philharmonic Orchestra, Saturday, January 25th at 8 p.m. at the Mahalia Jackson Theater. Jesse Rosen is president and CEO of the League of American Orchestras, an organization with more than 800 members. Rosen was in town recently for a meeting of the National Performance Network. He sat down with WWNO's Sharon Litwin for a conversation about the state of orchestras.
As a former executive director of our own Louisiana Philharmonic Orchestra, I have a more than passing interest in what's going on in the orchestra world these days. I have long considered Jesse Rosen one of the heroes in the field. A musician himself and a former orchestra CEO, he has been a friend of New Orleans and our symphony for a long time. So it's not surprising that while here, he took time to chat with a few of the LPO's musicians.
One of the things that came up that most people seem to agree on was that the transparency in how the organization was run was something everyone uniformly valued, and also the quality of relationship among musicians and administrators and board was something that they all valued really highly, the sense of collaboration and their ability to solve problems really easily and quickly. And they play beautifully, you know. I mean, they're just a great orchestra, and it's just always a joy to hear them.
For a long time, the innovative LPO model of a musician-owned, collaboratively managed orchestra made us the Rodney Dangerfield of the symphony world. We didn't get, as he would say, no respect. But after more than 20 years, that attitude, in fact, all attitudes about the role of orchestras has changed, even if the challenges haven't. So it's good to hear how other orchestras are adapting without dumbing down the music.
Definitely one of the most exciting places is the Los Angeles Philharmonic, which I think has been totally faithful to a core repertoire. And meanwhile, they were mounting tremendously innovative programs, both in their main classical series as well as in their new music concerts. And also they were producing festivals. You know, they were putting on raves and minimalism festivals and all kinds of things. So their understanding of the orchestral repertoire was that it was a slice of a spectrum of genres that it had a relationship to. So they maintained the core, but they built around it.
The LA Phil is not the only orchestra to have come up with new and creative ideas to engage the public. Baltimore is another.
Their program is called Rusty Musicians. So the symphony announces a date. They invite anyone who wants to come down to Meyerhoff Hall, and Maren Alsop, the music director, and members of the Baltimore Symphony sit on stage with amateurs, and they all play together. They rehearse it, and they perform a piece. And Baltimore also has taken this to a summer classical music fantasy camp. And for a week, the musicians can come, amateurs, and rehearse and play. And at the end of the week, they perform again with Maren and the symphony.
Money for the arts is tough to come by, so we can't be faulted for wondering whether the symphony world will be able to sustain itself into the future.
Kids keep coming out of college, out of high school. I mean, there's been a growth in youth orchestras. It's amazing. I mean, kids love playing in orchestras, which always amazes me because you think of all the influences that kids have that would lead them in other musical directions, yet somehow they want to play in orchestras. I'm not worried about that.
So if Jesse Rosen's not worried about it, I'm going to stop worrying about it too. To read more of Jesse Rosen's comments, go to WWNO.org or NOLAVIE.com. For WWNO, I'm Sharon Litwin.
You're listening to Inside the Arts on 89.9 WWNO, New Orleans Public Radio. I'm Diane Mack. A one-woman play, Golda's Balcony, follows the life of Golda Meir, the fourth prime minister of Israel and first woman to hold the position. The drama by playwright William Gibson follows Meir from Russian immigrant to American school teacher to Israeli prime minister. Big Easy award-winning actress Claire Moncrief is Golda in the production, which opens this week at Le Petit Theater. And she's here to talk about her role. Claire, welcome to Inside the Arts.
Hello.
You have big shoes to fill. What will you bring to this production?
I hope the ability to tell this story in the way Golda meant it to be told. The playwright had a lot of communication with Golda Meir just before her death. And so there is information in the play that a lot of people may not know generally. But the story is astounding. A woman born prior to 1900 who went on to do what she did in terms of taking on this political leadership role was really amazing at that time. And of course, she was one of the leaders of the Zionist movement to establish the State of Israel, and she got the job done. But there's so much more involved: her personal life, her personal motives and beliefs, the way she interacted with the political leaders. And believe me, she was definitely actively interacting with them at the height of the Yom Kippur Wars, which are tackled throughout the 95 minutes of the play. She was amazing, and I'm so honored to tell the story.
What does the term Golda's balcony refer to?
Golda's balcony referred to an observation post that was built inside an underground nuclear reactor and plant that the Israelis built because they anticipated that there was going to continue to be a lot of unrest in the Middle East surrounding their new state. And having been founded by people who came from World War II, Golda Meir herself was, she and her family were victims of the pogroms in Russia. And although she was not directly involved in World War II, as in her young adulthood, she was dealing with the people who were getting out of Europe. And everyone at that time was so terrifically impacted by the Holocaust, and she was one of them. And of course, she and all those people who founded the State of Israel were very much affected by that, possibly more than anything else in their history. And they decided that Israel needed to be prepared to defend itself from any other action taken by the outside world. And so they built a nuclear reactor long before anyone was aware that they had. That's why they built it underground. And, of course, everyone knows the story of the Olympians at Munich that were murdered and Israel's response to that later. There were wars in 1967. There were a series of conflicts with the Arab states surrounding Israel. And so by the time the Yom Kippur Wars occurred in 1973, Israel found itself considering whether or not to use the nuclear weapons. At that time, of course, the United States, President Nixon, had pledged support to Israel, but the support was not coming. That's planes, tanks, ammunition, all of those things. And Israel in the Yom Kippur Wars at that time was having a real struggle and were reached a point that where they felt that they might succumb to the Arab attacks. They definitely needed help, and the United States promised it but didn't deliver it. And at that point, the cabinet sat down, and Golda leading them as prime minister, and made the decision to utilize the nuclear weapons. And when they finally communicated that to the United States, Nixon and Kissinger finally actually sent what they had promised, and we were able to avoid what quite possibly could have been nuclear Armageddon. The Arabs were being armed by the Soviet Union, which is why Israel at that point was being beaten and needed help. And the United States promised it but didn't deliver. And so we come to that crucial point. There were phone calls. She talks about them, where she finally said to Kissinger, basically, my finger is on the button. So what are you going to do?
What is it that drew you to this production?
Clearly, an opportunity to play a role depicting the life of this woman of such strength and such accomplishment. Whether you agree with her views politically or not, once I read it then and saw how the script reveals her motives, where she came from, why she made these decisions that she did, that's what I found most fascinating. We learn about her private family relationships, her children. She struggled, as many women do, and certainly in those days did, with, do I stay with family? Do I stay with my husband? Or do I act on this passion that I have to build this new state because I can't do both things. And she talks about the results within her own life and within her family's life.
This was William Gibson's second attempt at telling the story of Golda Meir. And this one went on to become the longest-running one-woman show in Broadway history. What is it that draws audiences to this production?
It's like you're sitting in Golda's living room and meeting with her. And she's smoking her cigarette. And she's telling you how the world changed from those years just prior to World War II up through the Yom Kippur Wars in 1973 and this almost nuclear incident that might have occurred. And it's a history lesson that's fascinating, and it's live for you. And I would think people might enjoy being in Golda's living room.
What will audiences remember long after the curtain closes on this drama?
Probably they'll remember most what I think I'll remember, and that is the moment when the help arrives from the United States and Golda is able to remove the bombs from her military planes and the world goes back to peace. As she says, the Cold War becomes cold again. The personal toll that it took on her to take that step, to risk nuclear Armageddon, was probably incalculable in depth in her soul. And I think Gibson's script allows you to feel that.
Claire, thanks for stopping by.
Thank you for having me.
Golda's Balcony by William Gibson, starring Claire Moncrief, opens Friday at Le Petit Theatre, 616 St. Peter Street, with performances running through February 8th. And we have something extra in our Lanyap Corner. Loyola University's Montage Series continues with Loyola Opera's production of Mozart's The Magic Flute, Friday evening at 7:30 and Sunday afternoon at 2 in Roussel Hall on Loyola's main campus. More info at montage.loyno.edu. That's our show for this week. Inside the Arts is a production of WWNO. Our program is archived at WWNO.org. I'll be back with more ideas for your artistic palette next Tuesday at 1 p.m. when we'll go Inside the Arts. I'm Diane Mack.